You go to sing at the top of your lungs and play instruments and be free. You can join UBC Cry Club. UBC Cry Club provides instruments and a judgment-free zone for people to let loose and be free using music as therapy. UBC Cry Club meets at 8 p.m. on Wednesdays at the Fraser River Parkade. For more information, go to M01E on Instagram.
Tuned into Off the Beaten Path here on 101.9 CITR, CITR.ca, you know, if you tuned in digitally rather than on the analog, and I'm your host, Issa Arian. We do this every Tuesday, 10 to 11, here broadcasting live from the most western part of the Lower Mainland, from the unceded territory of the Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, Coast Salish, the nation's territory. Sorry. I was talking about that this week, and making sure to do it with the, doing the land acknowledgement with some enthusiasm, and also making sure that, that you're doing it right, if you're going to do it. And, it feels like a good week. I'm having like a very interesting past few days. I felt like over the weekend, my weekend was like perfectly, I don't want to say curated because I didn't curate anything, but it felt like one of those weekends where everything just kind of falls into itself, and it turned out great. And then Yesterday I woke up and couldn't hear. And I was like, wow. Glad I had such a great weekend because I still feel great. But yeah, this weekend, what did I do? This past weekend, I saw No Other Land. So that was a film by an Israeli journalist and a Palestinian filmmaker that won an Oscar on Sunday. So if you have the chance to check it out, I saw it at the Rio. If you're listening from the States, I don't think that they have a U.S. distributor, but you can still see it in Canada. I saw it at the Rio on Friday. It's kind of in the middle of the afternoon, so not sure if it was intentional, you know, that they made it difficult to see, but it was very much worth dipping out and making sure that one thing that I felt that was very powerful about the movie was, and something that I find to be very powerful about any type of media that I see come out of Palestine, is how incredibly honest the people are in talking about the stories and the things that they experience. There is, and it's one thing that I found really clear within the book, The Message, when I read Ta-Nehisi Coates' book. It's the clarity in which the situation kind of juxtapose with how we talk about the genocide or conflict as complex. But when you hear it out of the people who are suffering the most, they speak so clearly and are showcasing their life just full on display. And it is very difficult, and I would say impossible for me, but difficult clearly for some people, to see their stories as stories of people and not whatever they have in their mind about kind of who these people are. And so I think that was one of the things that was so powerful about the movie No Other Land. So if you get a chance, check it out. What else did I do on Saturday? I felt like this weekend I had a very somebody told me I had a very culture-filled weekend because I went to the Hubier here at the P&E, which was a great experience. I just feel very, grateful to be invited into a space and to be able to see how a different New Year celebration that I did not even know was happening. And, you know, as we talk about being on the unceded territory, it is it just felt like a privilege to be invited into this space, even though that the space in which we inhabit is the space where you should probably know the celebrations and things that are going on the land. But we don't always have kind of insights into that. And so the Hubier is the Nsagas people's New Year celebration. And so a lot of tribes from all over the West Coast of Canada come and get together and, and celebrate the New Year's with each other. And it was just a very family, warm vibes type of situation they had going on. And, it's one of those things where being so far away from home and so far away from my people, that it feels, it's nice to be around other people's celebration and kind of seeing that type of element. I mean, I love kind of the community elements. And so being invited into that space was very special. And then after that, I went to a friend show, which ended up being very different than what I expected, but also another kind of one of those feelings where the vibe was just very intimate and it just felt very good. So it was kind of a very special weekend to be able to spend it with a lot of friends and extended stranger family that kind of felt like just kind of felt very close, and it was nice. And then, it was a nice, beautiful weather weekend. You couldn't beat it. But what we'd like to do here on the show is we talk about what's going on here in the Lower Mainland, what's going on in Canada, what's going on in BC, what's going on, you know, throughout the world. And I have, and sometimes I have some special guests, sometimes we do some interviews. Today I have a very special interview that I will be playing in, I would say probably after the first break, which is with Ruby Smith Diaz, who wrote the book Searching for Seraphim, The Life and Legacy of Seraphim Joe Forte. So if you want to stay tuned, you want to make sure that you tune in, not just to kind of hear a little bit more about the story of Joe Forte, who he was, who he is, and or who he was and his kind of his story, and just kind of listen to kind of overall, kind of the interview kind of touches a little bit on BC history, but Black Canadian history, and kind of what does it look like in its best, and also what does it look like in its most challenging, and what does it kind of mean for today, and kind of record keeping, and kind of how we think about how the province and how particularly Lower Mainland was shaped. So when we come back, I have just kind of a few quick stories to talk about before we dive into the interview right after this musical and commercial break. If you'd like to call in, the number is 604-822-2487 at 604-UBC-CITR if you need to read. And listen, you can tell me about maybe something you did over the weekend. Maybe we'll talk about it on air. We'll be right back. Thank you. You are tuned in to Off the Beaten Path here on 101.9 CITR.ca. And so if you've been around, you've been hearing about some of the things that are going down and how, you know, going down in the United States and how they might be impacting you. So they keep pushing these tariffs off. I think they said institute tariffs today and then going to resend the tariffs tomorrow. And I have been curious on how I believe the tariffs will impact me. So obviously, I don't follow big tent politics. I also don't read too deeply into the policy, U.S. policy. So what I obviously, as a smart person, what I did was I found the memorandum, I downloaded it, and then I uploaded it into China's DeepSeek because, listen, if I'm going to be slapped with an extra tax, I want China to know about it. So I put it in the China's DeepSeek, and it kind of kicked me back things that not only I should know, but it told me what I should tell you. So just looking at the background on the U.S. tariffs, so thinking about the kinds of industries that will be impacted, mostly will be softwood lumber, aluminum, steel, and then kind of the economic ripples throughout the impacts on U.S. goods that are imported here in Canada and sold. And so, at least for myself, I don't buy too many, at least in the past few weeks, I've really noticed that I don't really buy too much shit at all. And second, the only thing that I really spend money on that's U.S. is my student loan, which sucks. But I'm still looking for what is going to have an impact on me personally. Like I can imagine kind of the ripple down effects of the lumber industry and then also steel, but that's just kind of, it feels like a little bit far detached from me living in Kitsilano. Like I don't do lumber, and I don't buy lumber. I don't build any houses. I don't own a house. These things feel like somebody else's problem, which isn't a great way to think about it because we're all here in this together. But just kind of looking at the kind of the relations and kind of the impacts, it doesn't seem to have a clear direct line to me. But that doesn't mean that we won't feel it because it feels as if whenever the Canadian dollar goes down, I feel it twice. So some of the things that we've heard and I have seen how stores and retail is battling back, and I've never seen so many Maple Leafs kind of in my life, which is kind of nuts because I felt like there was that one time it wasn't kind of cool to be nationalistic in Canada. It's still not cool in the States, except for how do I know what's cool and what's not cool? Because I don't think that this is cool, but clearly some people do. But it felt like in Canada, that was something that people shied away from. But just here on UBC's campus, as I was driving here, I saw someone's in a Canada hockey jersey, and I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to say this phenotype maybe leads me to maybe a wrong conclusion that this person might not have been wearing a Canada hockey jersey a few years ago so prominently. But it could just be my internal bias leading me down the wrong path. One thing that I do think that it is very interesting is that, I don't know if you've noticed, if you've known, but you know that I am a U.S. citizen, not yet a Canadian citizen, just a lowly permanent resident. And earlier, I don't even know if it was the weekend or earlier this week, it's kind of really hard to keep up with just kind of everything that's going on. But Donald Trump offered a gold card visa, which is a $5 million pathway for citizenship for wealthy investors from overseas to come to the United States and to become citizens. And this is not really, it feels like an immigration policy more than just like a sale of citizenship, just like a quick way to raise money, which if you are pimping out the immigration system, then it seems to work pretty good in your favor, especially if you are the one, some of the ones either collecting the $5 million or somehow working behind the scenes processing these payments or processing this. But I think that the policy should be about, they should let disgruntled American citizens sell their citizenship for $5 million, because that is a program that I get behind. Why can't I sell my citizenship on the free market? It feels like that should be capitalism's endgame. Like, I had the fortune, you know, doing one of these head nods to be born in the United States with a citizenship that's presumably worth $5 million. I should be able to sell that, because I personally think that, like, I had to do the math. Would I be better off having American citizenship, or would I be better off not having American citizenship but $5 million? And I did not see a scenario where having $5 million was worse than having American citizenship and no money. Because, you know, while I've gotten a little bit out of it, I don't think that I've gotten $5 million worth. There's no way to like recoup that money, but if I could sell it, I would definitely do that. So if, and Donald Trump gave me $5 million and told me never to come back, I guess you don't have to never come back if you get Canadian citizenship or somewhere else, but he wouldn't have to hear me again. He like wouldn't have to hear my black ass talk about him again. I would never mention that guy ever again in my life. We would just forget he existed. And so, with that being said, when we come back, we'll come back, and I want you to just, you know, make sure you go out and buy the book Searching for Seraphim from an independent bookstore. Ruby Smith Diaz will say that in the interview, but I searched for it all around. I even had some bookstores order it just because I feel that it is important history, particularly here in Vancouver, and you shouldn't have to go to Indigo to buy it. You should be able to buy local stories about local heroes or, you know, local mythical people and kind of like the local ethos, and it should be, you should be able to buy it at a local bookstore. But when we come back, you'll be hearing from me and Ruby Smith Diaz. So stay tuned.
Pull up with a minute, bring it back. Stupid, that ruthless, in love, Cuban. Hey. bring it back. Really like how you just go for it. Fuck up for the dubs, y'all ask something to show for it.
Yeah, so fat.
Girl, I put on the show for it. Waiting for the next time, I be looking so for it. Wait a minute, bring it back, love. I follow you holy, like I'm singing back up.
Just like that.
Get in and be ready to act up.
Hold up, wait a minute, bring it back.
Bring it back, girl. Ready to act up.
Hold up, wait a minute, bring it back.
Bring it back, girl. Bring it back, girl. Bring it back, yeah. Bring it back, girl. Wait a minute. Bring it back, girl.
Hold up, wait a minute, bring it back.
Really like how you just go for it. Fuck up for the dubs, y'all ask something to show for it.
Yeah, so fat.
Girl, I put on the show for it. Waiting for the next time, I be looking so for it. Wait a minute, bring it back, love. I follow you holy, like I'm singing back up.
Just like that.
Get in and be ready to act up. Bring it back, girl.
Since I went to UBC for graduate school, and love always meeting interesting people. Like my job is I'm a qualitative researcher, so like always just trying to meet people and really connect myself to the wider world. And you know, since moving here in Vancouver, I moved here in 2015, and from Washington D.C. and always have had this weird feeling, just kind of about. The way people talk about Joe Forte. So like I was so when I saw that your book came out on the CBC, I was like, oh, I would love to talk to her. So thank you. So tell me a little bit about you.
Yeah, I'm an Afro-Latina person, and I was born in Treaty 6 Amiskwichi, also colonially known as Edmonton and the traditional homelands of the Cree, Dene, Soto, Métis, Blackfoot, and Inuit nations. And I moved to so-called Vancouver, the traditional home of the Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh peoples around 2011, 2012. And I've spent the largest portion of my life actually there, or the larger portion of my life there, up until last year. So yeah, I guess like my work in the world revolves around body positive fitness. It also revolves around just like curiosity around history and actually finding out the histories of these lands prior to colonization. Learning about the histories of peoples that are not talked about when we talk about who made like the cities, the provinces, this country, what it is. I love learning about those kind of like more hidden histories. And a lot of my work also revolves around education. So often I'm in schools leading creative projects around Black histories and futures, and just interacting with youth and getting them to think about history as well as futures in a little bit more of an engaging way.
Cool. So thank you for sharing that. So, like, what inspired you to look into Joe Forte and write about him? Like, what really drew you to that story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Serafim, or as he's known more commonly as Joe Fortes, his story kind of popped out of nowhere in some ways. I was taking part of this Black History Month challenge that this person named Robert Liu Trujillo started a couple years ago. And I was looking through the archives to kind of recreate some element in a creative way of history, specifically from Black history in Vancouver. And I came across Serafim's image, and it just really just stood out to me in terms of like where he was situated. He had this like canvas tent beside him or behind him. He had this like very like proud, and also like I read it as like a little bit of like a knowing and kind of just like sparkle in his eye as well, like this look in his eye that just like caught my attention. And as I started reading more about him, when I found out that he was of mixed ancestry, that was the thing that immediately pulled me in, because I had never known another historical figure in Vancouver that was Afro-Latina, who was around the turn of the century doing things that brought the city's attention into what it is right now.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me a little bit about the title? You know, what's the significance of that to the story?
Yeah, Searching for Seraphim was a title that really spoke to recovering who this man was from the white gaze. So much of what has been written about him has been really dominated by white colonial narratives, including everything from weird speech cadences that would be like written in print at the turn of the century whenever they interviewed him, that you could kind of connect to, you know, the southern part of the United States, even though he was not from there, he never lived there, but all of a sudden he has these like speech patterns as if he was, to changing the location of where he's from, really highlighting that he was British, even though he was from Trinidad, and really erasing all these components of his story and turning him into kind of like what Peter James Hudson talks about, like a mascot. And so that like work of like searching for him was really what is captivated in the title, of trying to find out who he really is, who he really was, and also searching for maybe the story that he himself would have wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have long felt that distance from the story because of the narratives in which people tell it. I reject. Not like, and so I'm curious for you, you know, what do you feel like are some of the common misconceptions that people get about this story?
Yeah. I think the main misconception is that he was just happy to serve, and that he was happy as a Black man serving white folks predominantly in Vancouver without much pay, without much recognition, and that he was just happy to do it all day long, all year long. And there are definitely a couple moments that I found in the archives. This one actually just like made me just burst out laughing when I read. There was a feature around what Vancouverites were grateful for Thanksgiving. You know, people were talking about, oh, like my new house, or I got this gift or whatnot. They interviewed Seraphim, and his response was that the kiddies are finally going to stop coming to the beach. And that for me was just like such insight into just his humanity of like, hey, he may have, you know, put on this like super welcoming appearance and did what he had to do to kind of survive in a white supremacist context at the turn of the century. But that doesn't mean that this man didn't want rest. This doesn't mean that this man didn't get like sick and tired of kids constantly like wanting his attention or supervision. He was just like a real man. And I think a lot that's been written about him is that he was supposedly a servant and eager to serve. And, you know, I think a lot of Vancouver really latched on to that when it came to Seraphim and his story. And I think that's also what made him more palatable to Vancouverites, is that, okay, he is in a little bit of a role of submission. Therefore, he can become also a little bit more palatable and we can hold him in high esteem.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting, that particular moment. Were there some other moments that like really kind of surprised you or really stood out as kind of insights into this story is different than how it's told?
Yeah, to be honest, it was having to deal with my own disappointment around who he was. You know, I really looked up to everything that he was in terms of a lifeguard, how many people he saved, you know, and just like also being a Caribbean man. And like, to me, he almost felt like an uncle in many ways. Like there were like just pictures that I looked at him and like picturing him at like, you know, the table playing domino and like, you know, having like a little bit of rum or something with his domino. And like, there were so many things that like brought me closer to him. But then I also started uncovering things about him that I found deeply disappointing. And that to me was around just how he viewed people of Asian and Pacific Islander descent. And there are many instances as well in the archives where he suspects Asian people within his proximity or beyond, actually, where he was in English Bay or Yeltsin, where he suspects people of criminality, whether it be stealing or staking out a house. And these cases actually go to court, and they actually find that he had absolutely no evidence to prove or demonstrate that these people were actually guilty of theft or scoping out any houses. And in one case in particular, was this Chinese man that was actually just trying to get to the house that he was hired to go help, and he couldn't actually get to the house because Seraphim actually shoves him and makes sure that he can't get to the front entrance. Again, it was later proven in court that this man was just about to complete his duties, but Seraphim suspected that because he was a Chinese man, that he was up to something suspicious. And that to me just surprised me, because I'm just like, you are in a context where you are most likely the only Black man allowed to be on this beach in the 1900s, in the early 1900s, up until 1922. And you are in a context where people are marching down the street holding up signs that say "Stand for a White Canada," but you see yourself as a bit of an exception to that. Like, it just surprised me, because I'm just, the way that I see the world, I just think we as people of the global majority of like non-white heritage, we are in this together, in the ways in which like we have to battle so much racism in this world. And for me to put myself in a position where I would just be so discriminatory towards another racialized individual, I just was really taken aback and honestly really disappointed that he would have done something like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, how did that like challenge or kind of change your perspective about what you were hoping to find or about him? You know, and maybe the story he might have wanted people to tell.
Yeah, I mean, I think it changed my perspective of him and just made him more human, because I think that's essentially what all of our stories, you know, tell about us, is that we all make mistakes. We're all imperfect. And for me, even as a writer that wanted to do, you know, service to who he was and portray him accurately, it also meant digging into the parts that like maybe weren't so shiny and maybe weren't like the proudest moments. So that for me was like a really big takeaway of like really bringing in an element of like humanity to his story that I think many writers in different ways have avoided. But I was about to fall into the same trap by not including those things, because it kind of made him look bad, right? And so I think it's more of like a genuine exploration of who he was, and also to understand that like even the people that we hold in highest esteem, you know, sometimes make decisions that like maybe we wouldn't do, or that we would reconsider doing after.
Yeah. And I mean, and I know that sometimes, you know, there's some things that we don't want to talk about in mixed company, you know, that might be like a conversation that me and you might be able to have. But, you know, putting it in a book and kind of sharing that, you know, I'm curious, like how did that make you feel personally? How did that like make you kind of approach kind of like, I'm going to say more kind of historical writing and kind of thinking about these types of this context more generally? Did it like impact your perspective, or is, you know, I want to know how that felt.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, I mean, I think what it made me realize was just how sanitized and whitewashed historical figures genuinely and generally are. You know, it made me think a lot about the story of Frida Kahlo. And, you know, like, I think everybody knows who Frida Kahlo is now. Like, we see her on t-shirts and mugs and tote bags. You see her like unibrow and her like little monkey on her shoulder and a nice flower in her hair. But the ways that she actually depicts herself, she has like a huge like communist hammering sickle on her cast, on her very disabled body, that she like speaks about very often in her work, and that she like portrays in her work, and how much pain she was in. She has a lot of paintings that portray, you know, the role of American imperialism throughout Latin America. We never talk about that. We never discuss that. She was queer. She was polyamorous. Those are all parts of her story that are never discussed, and like in less than 100 years, we just know her as this woman with a unibrow who was an artist, right? And so that's what made me also like look to other figures in history where that has happened, and really made me think about the importance of actually writing. And I guess more in like, you know, the 21st century, like having our own words be written or be like said by us in a way that isn't edited, so that we actually have a sense of like who those individuals are that can't be deleted or erased or manipulated in any way. And I think that's also really the importance of archival work, because without the work of preserving these different parts of like social movements, of social works, like whether it be writing or other creative works, it's so easy for those stories to get snatched up, molded, rebranded, utilized for some other projects that oftentimes diverge from maybe what that person would have wanted, and used in many cases to, you know, manipulate folks into thinking something completely different about the person than maybe that what they wanted.
Okay. Oh, no. I 100% agree. My like two favorite, I would say favorite, but when I think about Black history or historical figures, I think of Kwame Ture and Paul Robeson. Those are like kind of my North Stars when I think about, you know, the type of the person I like to be. And both of those people feel like have been not only sanitized, but really kind of erased from kind of like the conversation around what can Black life look like? What does Black thought ideas look like? So, yes. So that's a great point. And so curious, like when you are thinking around, like, you know, what type of impact, you know, maybe this book has kind of in the kind of the lore around Black people in Vancouver, and also just kind of like Black Canadian history in general, like what place do you feel like it fits in there?
I think it's critical work. And I don't want to sound pretentious about that.
You can sound pretentious. Like, my show is like, you can say whatever you want.
I've honestly just gotten so many responses from racialized communities, but also Black communities, of people being like, thank you. I've been waiting for this story to be told in a realistic and genuine and authentic way, or I've been waiting for the story to be told by somebody from the Black community. And that to me just like has given me so much life, because I think we're all kind of like thinking the same thing of like, there's more to this story, or like, oh, what was said about him, that didn't sit right, but nobody has actually done the work of critiquing the ways in which he has been written about in the last 100 years. And I think that's important, because recovering those aspects also forces kind of like a mirror up to, you know, Vancouver, and the ways in which like we like to, or like the city in general likes to point to these elements of multiculturalism or these elements of diversity without actually doing the work that protects communities or uplifts them or makes sure that they, you know, have places to live, food to eat on their table, and that they live in dignified ways. And I think when we point out these divergences of like, yeah, you may have said that you adored him, that you loved him, but the way that you actually acted towards him tells us something different, actually invites accountability into that situation. And I mean, I say it still now in 2025, where there's so much of that happening right now, where we like to put, someone once said, a brown face in a high place, but we're actually not doing anything around uplifting racialized communities or Black communities or Indigenous communities and respecting their self-determination.
Mm-hmm. And so kind of with that, I'm curious, like what, I mean, as you're kind of researching Joe Forte and you're looking at kind of like what life was like back then for him, what was the context for him in Vancouver, you know, kind of like beyond, and I know I want to make sure people kind of go into the book and read about it, but love to know, like, what was Vancouver like for a Black man back then, or, you know, Black people in general?
Yeah, well, I think first I want to speak to just how much the city grew between 1890 to 1900, and then like a huge jump between 1900 and 1910. Like, I don't remember the exact statistic, but it's something like the population doubled within a period of 10 years and then doubled again in that next decade. And what that also meant is that the land completely changed, and And connected to the land completely changing in terms of these massive old growth trees, all these waterways that were also once in Vancouver that are now underground, is a displacement of Indigenous communities, right? And particularly where Seraphim Fortes is known to be, or what he called his beach, English Bay, or Yelshin, as its actual name is, that's Squamish territory. And people were displaced from there forcibly by the province and across the water where he would have looked at every single day. People were displaced by gunpoint, and put on a barge and taken to Hamilchison, another traditional territory of the Squamish people, but now onto a reservation. And so that's like the context at the turn of the century, where these like huge, rapid, sweeping forms of displacement, ecological destruction, and so much ecological destruction at the time that it became so difficult for people to breathe within the city with the amount of stumps and brush and things that were being burned and cleared. So a lot of folks actually went to the water at this time to try to get some fresh air, because the entire city was like covered in smoke. And for Seraphim, he would have been one of the very few people of African descent that was living in Vancouver at this time. If we look at kind of like the migration patterns generally in British Columbia at this time, a good portion of folks were invited by Governor James Douglas, who in my view is also a very controversial figure, very contentious figure, and it invited to settle lands in the interest of the British colony and in the interest of Canada, in Victoria and also on Salt Spring Island. And so those were like the main pockets of like Black communities, but there were also folks that came over from the United States and also through the railway lines, because being a porter was one of the few occupations that Black folks could hold at this time. But in general, the numbers were very low. And I think people had to be constantly on the lookout for their own safety. And like, I think they met some form of racism or discrimination every single day. And I talk about this in my book when Doc Johnson actually visits Vancouver, because this was a question in my mind of like, okay, Seraphim supposedly was treated well, or people like to write that he was treated so well and he was adored by Vancouverites, but would it have been the same for somebody else who was in equal standing in terms of like fandom and celebrity status at that time? And so I found the case of Jack Johnson, who was just fresh off this like really, really pivotal
the boxer?
Boxing match.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know he came to Vancouver. That's pretty
cool. He came to Vancouver, and like, you know, all the press and everything, like he gets off a boat that he had traveled on, and you know, the press is there like telling him like, how was it? Like, how was this match? It was a really important match in terms of like him fighting the quote last great white hope, and him coming up on top. But what happens that night is that Jack Johnson gets turned away from every single hotel in Vancouver that he approaches with his wife to stay at. He, I think, searches 5 or 6 hotels, gets turned away from every single one, and then finally ends up crashing on the couch of this trainer for boxers, George Paris, I think his name was. And he ends up staying there. It was another Black man. And can't find anywhere to stay in the city. So that to me also spoke volumes of, okay, so the city greets him by day with all of the celebrity, and then by night tells him that they do not allow Black people to stay at their hotels. I think that's very telling of the city.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I know about Jack Johnson, but didn't know that he visited Vancouver. So I'll definitely have to look into that. And I guess I have like 2 more questions, but one, I'm like, what was, you know, they talk about Jack Johnson as like they talk about Joe as like a singular figure. Like, what were his relationships like? Did you get any insight into, you know, they treated him well, but like, what about his interpersonal relationships, you know, with, you know, partners or just kind of like people in general in the city?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really curious about that as well. In terms of his interpersonal relationships, the closest he had was with another Black family, the Scurry family, who are like their daughters or like their lineage is also, you know, the famous Barbara Howard, who was the first Black teacher to work in the Vancouver School Board, and she's a track athlete. And that family is the one that he builds the closest bond to. And, you know, he kind of leaves some of his belongings, some of his earthly possessions to one of the daughters actually of that family after he passes. And in terms of like other relationships, nobody else is really named in the archives in terms of somebody who he was close with on a daily basis. That to me also kind of like sparked some questions in terms of like, okay, did he ever fall in love with anybody? Like 30 years is a long time to be in Vancouver and like maybe not want to date. And maybe that was also his sexual orientation. Maybe he was asexual, or maybe he did fall in love, but he didn't want the person who he chose to be under scrutiny because Seraphim himself was in the spotlight so much in Vancouver. Whether that person would have been somebody of the same gender as him, somebody of a different gender as him, somebody who was Black, somebody who was white, all of these possibilities would have had consequences for whatever he would have chosen. And there's many portions as well where, or not many portions, but there's a couple different references that he makes with reporters where he kind of stops himself from answering the questions that they want to know. And he answers, "I'm keeping this for my little book." And so that to me was maybe his way of just like, I want this actually to be told in my own words. I'm so curious also where that book wound up, if it ever actually ended up being something, but I think he saw the importance of maybe keeping to himself and maybe one day sharing that story in a way that wouldn't be told by somebody else that wasn't him.
Mm-hmm. Like not so sensationalized or anything like that. Okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And so for you, well, I want to know, like, for you, like, one, where can people find the book? You know, where can people find the book or find out more about you or kind of find out more about what you plan on doing next?
Yeah. So you can order my book through the Arsenal Pulp Press website, or you can find my book at local independent bookstores. There are also many copies throughout the Lower Mainland at libraries as well, or you can request it at your local library. But yes, definitely shop independent. And you can also find out more about my work on Instagram. If you want to know more about my body positive fitness, you can find me at autonomyfitness_ on Instagram. Or if you want to find out more about my artistic work and my book work, it's Tierra Negra Arts on Instagram as well. My website is www.tierranegraarts.ca.
Cool. Well, thank you. Is there any other things that you like kind of want people to know kind of about Joe or about the book in general or about Vancouver during that time? Because I think that for me, someone who's always like, you know, I read Go Do Some Great Thing as soon as I found out about it, and just trying to make sure that I'm as a non-Canadian, like trying to make sure I understand the kind of the perspective of Black life here is different than from where I'm from in DC. Like it is, it's kind of like I feel like I have a privilege of being from DC. For me, is just kind of like it feels I love it here, but it's just different. So I want to know kind of more specifically about here, like, is there anything that you'd like to share else, or you know, about like Joe, or about kind of what you learned in general?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is let's start a movement and/or let's bring his name back. Mm-hmm. So Seraphim, right? He signs his name as Seraphim Fortes, and again, even though his middle name is Joseph. Seraphim means the highest order of angels. And I strongly believe that our names that we're given, especially within like Afro-Latino, but also just the larger African diaspora, have power and they have meaning. And it really just like hurts me and kills me when I hear people's names be turned into something else because it's just easier for them, or they remember it, or that other name doesn't make sense for that person, so they become a Joe, for example, you know. And again, the name Joe, again, there's like this kind of minstrel fantasy attached to it around just like cotton picking and like other like the old Black Joe, like all these songs that are connected to it that all of a sudden becomes, you know, connected to his whole being. And so in my efforts to search for his story, I think it's really important that we also recognize that like his name was Seraphim. And I think white folks in Vancouver really leaned into calling him Joe to lean into that fantasy, and because it was easier. And as the other writer who has written a biography about him, Lisa Ann Smith, suggests, that highest order of angels didn't really land well with Vancouverites for a Black man. So they probably named him something else. And so for me, I say Seraphim to like reclaim his name and his identity. And yes, a Black man can be an angel and can be godly and can be good of nature. We know this. But for me, it's important to just like say his name as he would have signed it as well.
Back at All The Empath here on 101.9 CITR.ca. Thank you to Ruby Smith-Diaz for joining us today. So, you know, like what we like to do here is I'll end kind of with a, I don't know if this is a funny story, but it is a story. So all types of crazy shit goes on. And all types of crazy shit goes on in the just kind of in the world. And so one of those things was Citigroup mistakenly credited a customer with $81 trillion in their account for a few hours before it was noticed and reversed. And that's like one of those things where, I mean, we might have talked about this on the before where you get credited an account and you're not supposed to spend that money. You're definitely not supposed to spend that money. But $81 trillion, I would try. I would absolutely try. It just feels like too much. You got to take the risk. Like there's some risk that needs to be taken. Like even if you could take a little bit, you know, maybe you buy some Bitcoin or something like that. You know, you figure it out. But obviously that's not private either. Like there's no way to hide money anymore. I think that's one of the things that, you know, that we've lost in this digital age. But what we've gained is the ability to share information and look up information at a speed and a scale that we never thought was possible. So that's why I wanted to thank Ruby Smith-Diaz again for coming on the show, sharing about Seraphim. I don't even know if I know anybody who knew his first name was Seraphim, because I talked with people who I feel are BC historians, and that's not something that they felt has ever come up and or even been questioned. And so I think just kind of tapping on that, just understanding that if you don't know this person's name, and you know, we have been sharing, I say we as a collective because I feel like I've been here 10 years, you know, sharing his story for 10 years and not even knowing his real name, how much do we really know about his experience and the experience of others like him in Vancouver at the turn of the century? For me, it was so interesting to hear about Jack Johnson and his visit to Vancouver, because I think that shows it really shows and highlights where we weren't at that time, or where Vancouver wasn't at that time, to show one of the most famous athletes in the world come to the city, and he still is unable to stay in a hotel in a country in which believes itself to be just a little bit further ahead. So with that being said, listen, we try to do this every week on Off the Beaten Path here on Tuesdays from 10 to 11. Tune in every week from starting at 8 so you can tap into Crimes and Treasons, the best and hottest hip-hop show in Canada, in the West Coast of Canada, in Central Coast.